Playing for Prokofiev, Mir Seidel. In the dream, my grandmother has come for dinner. The other guests are my mother and my brother Bob, both of them gone now, too. My grandmother sits at the head of the table, dressed up in one of her Guatemalan skirts and her sparkling beaded jacket. She's old. She lived to 93, but vibrant, her face animated, talking and laughing. In life, she covered her mouth when she laughed, self-conscious about her crooked smile. In the dream, she doesn't. To me, she always had white hair, worn in two braids, pinned up in a circle. Old photos help me imagine her in the fall of 1919, age 19, with black hair matching her penetrating dark eyes. In this undocumented scene, she's sitting at an upright piano in a dance studio, looking at a handwritten music score with the composer, Sergei Prokofiev, standing beside her. She's never played anything like it. She can hear it in her head as she looks over the first pages. A burst of staccato voices like fireworks in shifting keys and time signatures, battling one another for attention. An impossible cacophony, nothing like the Beethoven, Schubert, and Bach she's studied. The composer, a tall young man with blonde hair, can't explain it to her because he only speaks Russian. Gussie, my grandmother, only speaks English and Yiddish, even though her parents emigrated from Russia to New York City before she was born here on the first day of the 20th century. Still, it's music. She straightens herself on the bench, leans forward, and begins to play. The studio belonged to the choreographer Adolf Bohm, who was working with Prokofiev on this new project. The score was the piano version of Prokofiev's opera, The Love for Three Oranges. My 19-year-old grandmother would accompany the dancers and singers as they prepared for its premiere with the Chicago Opera, set for early 1920. No one except the composer had heard those notes before Gussie played them. The opera was eventually produced in America and Europe, and it's considered one of the earliest and most iconic modernist operas. My grandmother was an aspiring concert pianist. She had already given herself a new name, Augusta, to go with her old nickname, leaving behind her given name, Margolia. She still lived with her parents, who ran a strictly kosher restaurant on New York's Lower East Side. She had played piano since an uncle recognized her ear for music and insisted on her getting lessons. Gussie's talents had brought her some attention already, including an audition for the conductor Arturo Toscanini. She hadn't gone to college or a conservatory. Either one would have been unusual for a girl from a working-class Jewish family then. But she'd had some introduction to a wider cultural world through Madison House, the settlement house that the Ethical Culture Society ran to help recent immigrants. Apparently, she played the score well. After a month of rehearsals, Bohm invited her to come to Chicago and play for the rehearsals there. She would travel and stay with Bohm and his wife Beata, a former ballerina. I imagine that the Bohms, a charming and worldly married couple, soothed her parents' concerns about their daughter traveling so far away. Gussie's fiancé, Ben, also agreed to wait till she returned to get married. She and the Bohms got on the train for Chicago in mid-November. All these people had been affected by the events of the past 5 years, the Great War, which had ended exactly a year before, the Russian Revolution, and the Spanish flu, the great influenza epidemic of 1918. My grandmother's brother had died of the flu, pulling a curtain of grief over the family. Prokofiev, who was 27, had left a promising career as a piano soloist, conductor, and avant-garde composer in Russia and Europe, escaping the uncertainties of the new Bolshevik regime for America. He'd ridden by train east through Siberia, past troops battling to take over the rail line, to Vladivostok, then Japan, and to San Francisco, where he was detained as a suspected Bolshevik before traveling to New York. As hard as the trip was, he had thought it was only temporary and left behind most of his scores. Many of them were lost during the upheavals after the revolution. Adolf Böhm, a fellow Russian who was then 35, had also escaped the disruptions of war. He landed in New York only a few years earlier, forsaking ballet stardom in Europe. Long before I learned about any of this, I had stared at a framed sepia photo in my grandfather's study, showing a male dancer in stylized profile, wearing what looked to me like an Egyptian costume. An inscription to Augusta Abramson Scheiber travels in a confident scrawl across the image, signed Adolf Böhm. The photograph's air of long-ago, exotic theatricality and the dancer's neon-bright charisma mesmerized me. Böhm had risen to lead roles with the Mariinsky Ballet in St. Petersburg and went on to partner with Anna Pavlova on her first European tour in 1909. Soon after, he decamped to Paris to join Serge Diaghilev's Ballet Russe as a dancer and choreographer. Diaghilev's company had just begun upending the performing arts with its intoxicating fusion of commanding visuals, sensuous dancing, and experimental music, allowing figures like Igor Stravinsky and Vaclav Nijinsky to explode onto the scene. Böhm made such a sensation dancing in the Ballet Russe Prince Igor that one night audience members tore off the orchestra rail in a frenzy of appreciation. He went on to appear in many of the company's pioneering performances, including the iconic Stravinsky ballets Firebird and Petrushka. When World War I made it impossible for the Ballet Russe to perform in Paris, Böhm traveled to New York for Diaghilev to organize a season in 1916. Encouraged by its success, he stayed on and put together a small company of his own, the Ballet Intime. I'm pretty sure his pose in my grandmother's photo is an excerpt from a Ballet Intime piece called Egyptian Nights. Böhm and Prokofiev probably met in Paris through the Ballet Russe. When Prokofiev got to New York in 1918, he stayed with the Böhms in their apartment on 59th Street, with the dance studio down the hall. Stepping off the train in Chicago, Gussie found that her coat didn't protect her against the freezing winter wind. Mrs. Böhm gave her a coat, a generosity the younger woman never forgot. In New York, she and Ben had many friends from Madison House, but staying now with the Böhms in Chicago, she found herself in the middle of a community of forward-thinking bohemian musicians, dancers, and artists. In long letters she wrote to Ben, Gussie described her experiences with these people. She went with the Böhms and some others to a performance by Rachmaninoff. His playing was superb, she wrote. It made me so angry with myself. I felt like working and working at my music to play even a little better. Another evening, she came back from a dinner out with a young dancer and a musician, only to find she'd missed a concert ticket that Böhm had left for her for a performance of work by Mr. Carpenter. That was John Alden Carpenter, the modernist composer and arts patron. She visited a household of two women artists whose home struck her with its combination of coziness and beauty. They had supper around the fireplace, and the ladies showed them the very out-of-the-ordinary dresses and blouses they designed. Were they a lesbian couple? Did their unusual clothing line influence Gussie's later proto-bohemian style? Later that same night, she walked with the others to the lake. They turned their backs to the lights and gazed into the distance over the great dark expanse of Lake Michigan. Rehearsals went well, though Prokofiev was a curt and distant conductor, and it was a continuing challenge for her to have to stop and leap back into passages with all the jumpy, unexpected tonalities and rhythms. Mrs. Carpenter told her how much they all admired her playing. One day, when Mr. Bohm was feeling ill, he asked her to attend the orchestra rehearsal at the opera house and report back to him whether they were playing the music the way he wanted. "I felt very important, I can tell you," she reported teasingly to Ben. When she returned, Bohm engaged her in a long conversation. She told him for the first time about her engagement and her life in New York. Bohm asked her, "Do you think marriage will help you to develop your work?" Gus said that her fiancé supported her career and she would only blame herself if she couldn't manage. Then, in mid-December, disaster struck. The director of the Chicago Opera, Cleofonte Campanini, fell ill with pneumonia. He died on December 19th. Without his support for the wildly innovative production, the opera was canceled and rehearsals came to a sudden stop. I don't know if Gus, at her piano in the rehearsal room, ever got a sense of the opera's concept and staging. Now, she would never see it. The Love for Three Oranges would finally premiere 2 years later under the opera's next musical director. I got to see it in Philadelphia in 2019, 100 years after its intended debut. I went with a friend, excited by the family connection, but not knowing what to expect. Still, I was amazed by the freewheeling modernist absurdism of the story, visuals, and music. Orange's original story comes from a satirical fairy tale staged in 18th century Venice and shows its commedia dell'arte roots. Prokofiev's libretto includes a play within a play element. We hear meta-commentary from various artistic factions on the unfolding story of a prince who can't laugh because he's read too much tragedy. The prince's quest for three oranges leads him through some surreal twists and finally to true love. The story was a perfect fit for Prokofiev. With his astringent, playful musical style, he preferred satire and burlesque to the high romance of traditional opera. Once the premiere was canceled, Gussie's services were no longer needed, and she made plans to return to New York. But the Bohms had decided to stay on. Bohm was already smitten with the country's energy and promise, writing in a letter that he found Chicago symbolic of creative, restless America and immensely alive, and its avant-garde community made it more welcoming than New York. "Before my grandmother left Chicago," the Bohms had another talk with her. "I picture it happening on the railroad platform, but more likely it was the day before she traveled. 'You have a special gift,' they said to her. 'You're young, too young to get married. You need to have the freedom to concentrate on your music. Stay with us here. We will help you.'" Bohm was a teacher and mentor to many young artists. By nature, he tended to gather talent around him. He clearly cared about Gus. But Adolf's and Beata's invitation hit her like a hard slap. She saw two possible lives stretching before her, one here in this strange city, with a mentor who knew what she was capable of, and a group of fascinating artistic friends, and the other in New York, the life she'd been imagining, with Ben and her family and all she had ever known. She was in love with Ben, a young lawyer who wrote poetry, who had been so supportive of her music and even of her going on this trip. She chose to get on the train and go back to Ben, my grandfather. On the train ride home, she told me, she wrestled with a tangle of knotted string, pulling at it with her strong pianist's hands, trying to untangle her choices, to convince herself they could be resolved. "Oh, Gussie, I feel for her in that moment, the pain of her choice. I'm torn as she was. I want to root for her to choose to stay. But then she wouldn't have married Ben, and none of her children and grandchildren would have been born. Gus, that's what we grandchildren called her, didn't tell me about her time with Prokofiev and Bohm till she was in her 80s. I think it was just too painful for her to talk about that moment of promise when everything seemed to open before her and she turned away from it. By the time she brought it up, I'd gotten married myself." Years before, though, we had played a Prokofiev piece together in a chamber concert we performed at my college. Even when we rehearsed the Prokofiev, she hadn't mentioned working with him. We played to a small audience. I hadn't publicized it much, out of a combination of spaciness and ambivalence. A few months later, I would change my major from music to psychology, and a few years after that, I went to art school. When we played that concert, she was at the top of her game, about the age I am now, and I was about as old as she had been when she came back from Chicago to marry Ben. You could look at Gussie's adventure and her dilemma as part of that fraught moment coming out of the end of the war and the terrible pandemic that followed. You could say that she set aside adventure and maybe tried to mend her own family's loss by turning toward love and marriage. You could also see Prokofiev's love for Three Oranges as his own post-war, post-Russian Revolution manifesto. We shouldn't get lost in tragedy like the young prince did, but should find ways to laugh and eventually find love. Even though the opera was not a departure, he'd been working this way before the war. It announced his commitment to leaving behind the weight of old traditions. When Love for Three Oranges finally premiered a few years later, the Chicago audience and critics gave it a mostly positive response, although one dismissed it as Russian jazz with Bolshevik trimmings. I'm sure Gus didn't go to see it when it premiered in New York the following year, because she had just given birth to my father, Walter, a few weeks before the performance. Prokofiev moved back to Europe and returned to Russia by the mid-1930s. He kept producing music through the Soviet era, including operas and instrumental works, and the score for Eisenstein's film, Alexander Nevsky. But the growing pressures of Stalinism left him artistically isolated and impoverished in his later years. He died on the same day Stalin did, March 5, 1953. Adolf Böhm flourished in Chicago. He and Beata welcomed their only child the following summer. He began a ballet school. He choreographed a jazz ballet based on the comic strip Crazy Cat with music by Carpenter. He became ballet master and principal dancer for the new Chicago Civic Opera and co-founded another company to produce new ballets. In 1931, he moved to Los Angeles, following the thread of opportunity in the form of an invitation to work on a John Barrymore film, The Mad Genius. He staged ballets at the Hollywood Bowl, including a ballet mécanique with dancers playing gears, pistons, and dynamos, and some of Diaghilev's masterworks. He helped found the San Francisco Ballet and created dancers for the young American Ballet Theater in the 1940s. He died in Los Angeles in 1951, having become a kind of Johnny Appleseed for ballet, especially modern ballet, seeding schools, companies, and audiences around America. Gus married Ben on her birthday, New Year's Day, 1920. When her parents presented her with a set of pots as her wedding gift, she was horrified, sure that her choice had landed her in a domestic trap. After that, she avoided cooking as much as she could. She and Ben had three children, raised them in a townhouse in Greenwich Village, and welcomed a circle of musical and non-musical friends there. Their marriage lasted over 60 years and knew its share of exasperations and compromise. So it was a shock for me to read those long-ago letters, found in Ben's desk drawer after she died, filled with jokes, loving nicknames, and such high hopes. She never stopped playing. My father remembered crawling under her grand piano to play with his toy fire engine to the booming chords of Bach. When I was little and was carried upstairs in my grandparents' home to sleep, I felt the music enter my body through the floorboards as she played downstairs. She encouraged all her children and grandchildren to make music, although none of us had her level of talent. She played many benefit concerts, performed live on WQXR and WNYC, and about every 10 years played at Town Hall, receiving respectful critical notices. Her repertoire reflected her love of Beethoven, Schumann, and Schubert, and betrayed no lingering modern influences. Ben kept a voluminous scrapbook documenting her performances. She didn't give up her music, but her career, such as it was, marks a trail of negotiations that women artists made then and still make, trying to balance their art and their personal lives, including love and often children. For her to have achieved more renown, I wonder if Gus would have had to be more pushy, more self-centered, more sure of herself. Or maybe she just needed to have been born 100 years later. But she was herself in her own time. My mother, who was a writer, had to make similar choices in her life, and I have too, trying, not always gracefully, to balance being married, having a child, and making a living with the commitment to a creative life. Gussie made her choice. Sometimes, though, she would run away. She told me this much later, too. When she was overwhelmed by the children and being a wife to Ben and felt her music slipping away from her, she would drive upstate and spend a few nights by herself in a motel. Motels didn't have pianos, but she could practice pieces in her head, which she did when she couldn't play. Maybe she heard it more clearly then. Driving off from the home she'd made, did she also feel regret for the path she didn't take, with its promises of artistic fulfillment and a more carefree bohemian life? At that long-ago moment in 1919, my grandmother had chosen the path promising love and connection and stability. After that, she unraveled her knot the best she could. But her commitment to the music never wavered. That's inside me, too, like the music that vibrated its way into me. Knowing there was a way to tend my art in spite of life pulling in other directions. It's never a perfect balance. I had that dream of her coming for dinner, laughing and joking, as I was working on this essay. The Gussie in that dream is both the one I knew and the one I didn't know, with possibilities reverberating around her like overtones. An old woman, dressed to the nines, shining with all the promises, even the ones she didn't live to see fulfilled.